And the best kind of constraint, in fact. So I assume in this room that since this is a more technical workshop, do I have this thing turned on? Yes, I do. That I don't have to spend, normally the 4 or 5 slides you would spend explaining what inflation is and why it's a good idea and how it was invented in the early 80s. I'm basically going to take those as read. And what I want to do is I want to focus on if we assume that there was a period of inflation in the very early universe, and I must say, even though Paul Steinhardt's not here at the moment, I know he's coming tomorrow, and I just want to add that I mean inflation in the very broadest sense, and so that would include something like ekpyrosis, for instance. I'm really talking about any phase in the early universe where the co-moving size of the horizon is getting smaller. And so what we're trying to do now is we're sort of at this position where if we look at, say, the correlation between the E-mode and the T-mode in the CMB data, we see this very clear evidence that it seems that the primordial perturbations were somehow laid down when they would have been outside of the present horizon. In other words, you either have to have some sort of magical super horizon physics going on, or alternatively, you have to have some region, some epoch in the early universe when the co-moving size of the horizon was shrinking in such a way as you could lay the perturbations down at early times, you shrink the horizon size, and then when the horizon grows again, they're magically there to re-enter the horizon. And on the other hand, what we're going to find out, and what we find out when we think about this, is that inflation, the job of inflation, is to produce a very, very smooth and very, very featureless universe. This is the attraction of inflation. It takes, pretty much arbitrary set of initial conditions, and it drives them towards this very homogeneous, very isotropic universe. And so what we want to do is that inflation is kind of famously this beautiful idea, but it lacks a kind of clear model, there's no kind of standard model of inflation, or sort of minimal model of inflation in the way that there is with the Higgs, for instance, where we have this kind of idea of a minimal Higgs model or a minimal supersymmetric standard model, and then anything more baroque that we add to our understanding of, say, particle physics at the LHC is somehow seen in contrast to that. And inflation really doesn't have a well-motivated model that we can see as the canonical model. And so we've got maybe 20 or 30 different ways of implementing inflation, and we have to then use data, obviously, to try and discriminate between those different models. And that's the sort of gist of what I'm going to be talking about today. So I'm going to give a very, I'm going to touch on 3 different ways of constraining inflation. And whenever I give this talk, I always run out of time before I get a chance to say anything about non-Gaussianity in a trivial way, but I'm always optimistically including it as my third point. The other 2 things that I'm going to talk about, one is simply the sort of inverse problem of inflation. If we believe that the primordial perturbations that we see in the sky were produced by some period of inflation in the early universe, which is a minimal assumption we can assume is produced by a single minimally coupled scalar field in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, then the question is can we take data, can we take observations and then try and reconstruct that potential from data? In other words, can we solve this problem? So I'm going to talk about some progress that I've made on that, particularly with Hiranya Pierce and also more recently with my graduate student Peter Adsed. The next thing I'm going to look at is also a novel way of producing gravitational waves from inflation. And so these aren't the usual gravitational waves that you learned about in high school that source the B-mode of the microwave background anisotropies on very large scales. These are gravitational waves that are produced at the phase transition that occurs at the end of inflation. They're not compulsory. They don't have to be generated. But in a surprising number of models, you get this production of gravitational radiation without having to add any further 3 parameters. So it's definitely something we could think about. But the scales involved mean that these correspond to scales that were co-moving scales that were on the order of the horizon size at the end of inflation. And so they're anything between about that big through to maybe millions of kilometers if inflation ends at the TeV scale. So we're talking about gravitational waves that could be observed either, if we're lucky, in tabletop experiments or potentially in solar system experiments, but not the sort of gravitational waves that would be sourcing the microwave background, which obviously are things with astrophysically big wavelengths. And finally, the non-Gaussianity. Whenever we talk about the CMB, or whenever we show the power spectrum, what we're actually looking at is the two-point function. So in some sense, you could imagine we know what the average temperature is, and then you take the temperature at every spot in the sky, in some appropriately pixelated way, and then you make a histogram of the temperature of those different spots. And you've subtracted the foregrounds. Then you ask yourself, well, what is the distribution of hot and cold spots relative to the mean? And so when we talk about the average, you know that if you have a distribution, that in principle that a distribution is defined by by a very large number of parameters if you have to calculate the various moments of the distribution. Theoretically, we have good reason from inflation for believing that this distribution should be almost exactly Gaussian. And you know that if you have a Gaussian distribution, once you know what its width is, then you know what the third moment is. You know that all the odd moments are zero because you're essentially integrating an odd function over an even function. And you know what all the higher, the average value of the fourth power and a sixth power. You know what all of those things are in terms of the lowest order moment that you measured. And so what we're going to discover is that certain models of inflation can actually produce a substantial non-Gaussianity, and actually calculating that non-Gaussianity and then comparing it to the sky is going to be something that is a way of wringing information out of the CMB that's potentially orthogonal to what we measure when we simply look at the density perturbation so far. So if you could see this signal, if you could see a non-zero signal, then this would give you a strong cut on the parameter space of any primordial models that you were thinking about. So let's just back up for a little bit and present this. Now, this is this kind of standard picture of the universe, and everyone steals this from the WMAP site. So because this is WMAP, they have their picture of their satellites. So the whole purpose of this entire 13.7 billion years of evolution is to produce this little satellite that sits here and looks backwards. And, you know, you could argue that's not a bad way to spend 13.7 billion years, because it's a very impressive satellite. So when we look at this, to remind ourselves what we're seeing is, when we look at cosmology, we don't have we don't do experiments in cosmology. We know people talk about microwave background experiments, but these are observations, and so we're forced to take the universe as we find it. Our particle physics colleagues, for instance, will try and isolate the single variable that they want to look at by excluding all their backgrounds and other processes. But we have to look. When we look at the CMB, or even worse, at the sort of inflationary phase, we're actually looking at the integrated history of the universe. And so whenever we see the sky, we somehow have to, in some sense, we may want to back out something like, say, the present value of the cosmological constant. If we're thinking about inflation, this isn't necessarily an interesting number, but it's something we have to take into account. So we have this long period where we have this period of accelerating expansion. We have this period after sometime in the very early universe before which you don't have stars, after which the first stars turn on, the universe reionizes, and you can start to actually see stuff. We have the CMB at a redshift of about 1,000, and then we have the very early universe down here. I'll just mention in passing, although I'm not going to make a lot of it in my talk, and this region here can in fact be probed. It's not emitting, there's no stars, so it's not emitting light. But the universe is essentially neutral hydrogen in this region here, and so there's a number of very promising experiments looking at the neutral hydrogen, as everyone knows, has prefers to be this rather than this, and the wavelength that differentiates between those two states in the lab frame would be 21 centimeters long. But if you have neutral hydrogen at a redshift of 10, it turns out that wavelength will be 2.1 meters, and so if you can observe the universe at a wavelength of 2.1 meters, in principle, at least, you can map out the distribution of neutral hydrogen at a redshift of 10. And because this is a line we're talking about, you can not only get it at a redshift of 10 by cranking the dial on the tuner slightly, like a car radio, you can get it at a redshift of 11 and a redshift of 12. So you can rebuild a map of the universe during the so-called dark ages. No one's, of course, done this, but it's something that, in some sense, it's physicists like this idea because it's like the CMB, at least until reionization becomes, you're looking at the universe typically in linear system. You have to worry less about the sort of astrophysics that you worry about when you try to use galaxies or galaxy clusters as a probe. And so I think I'm just sort of marking this as something that I think is going to be increasingly important once the technological challenge of actually observing these photons has been solved. So just to remind you again about how much things have improved, this is the famous CFA stickman figure. This is a large-scale structure survey from the early 1980s. And this is a large-scale structure survey from approximately two decades later. And the key point is that there's a whole lot more information in this slide than there was in the previous slide. And so whatever theoretical test we come up to do that somehow makes use of this information. We can obviously, the same test applied to this data is obviously going to give us far tighter constraints than would have been possible a couple of decades from now. And it's very reasonable to imagine that if we extrapolate, a similar distance into the future, that the data will have improved by the same order of magnitude. And therefore, we're looking at, the sort of beginning of an age where we can really think about doing precision cosmology. And on top of that, the precision in which we can do things is definitely going to increase for quite some time to come. Likewise, the CMB, this is the COBE map, and this is the WMAP map. And again, the key thing that to realize is there's just far more information in this picture than there was in the previous one. So again, any kind of constraint we could get on cosmology from the WMAP sky is obviously going to be hundreds of times better when you consider the extra information that lives inside of this picture. So there's one last kind of setup thing that I want to say when I go into detail, or before I go into a little bit more detail, is that I think when we're doing this as theoreticians, it's always important to keep that kind of time frame in mind. And so what I'm trying to think about at the moment are ways not that we can necessarily test inflation with present data, but ways in which we might be able to test inflation if the sort of things that our experimentalist and observationalist colleagues are pulled off. And now, a space mission, for instance, often has a 10 or 20-year lead time between the point where people start thinking about it, the mission is built, it flies, and then you actually reduce the data. So it's not unreasonable to be thinking about things that are happening, you know, that won't be doable for a long time in the future. And I think our guiding light here is, in fact, that the CMB itself was first knowingly detected in 1965. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, we can find people, you know, who some, you know, prior to that had also seen it, but then, you know, the key detection was made in 1965. The first paper on temperature anisotropies was written in 1967. This is a paper by Sachs and Wolf, who were focusing on the, you know, the largest scale anisotropies. These are the, this is the mechanism that's responsible for producing, you know, the flat tail at low L. This signal was first detected in 1992 by Kobe, and of course this is what got the Kobe people the Nobel Prize. And so it's very clearly, you know, this 25-year lag between theory and experiment. And I think the sort of things that we're talking about now will be, you know, testable in possibly 25 years' time. So it seems that this sort of timescale is not something that's unreasonable inside of this field. On the other hand, if we're talking about something that can't be done for 100 years, then obviously, you know, that would be a largely academic exercise. But I think it's definitely true that, you know, the theorists, because these missions are being designed today, that as, you know, theorists, we definitely need to be taking the long view here. So I'm going to, with the exception of the first thing that I'm talking about, I'm primarily thinking about future possibilities rather than present data. The problem that we face is this, is that inflation is intended to make the early universe featureless. We don't know how inflation happened. We've got lots of different models, and only one of them at most can be right. I mean, there's no guarantee that inflation happened at all, but certainly if it did happen, it only happened. Now, there's only one, you know, mechanism of inflation. And so all we're going to have to do is we've got this universe that's been made very, very smooth, and then we're going to have to tell one kind of very, very smooth universe from another kind of very, very smooth universe. And that is typically going to require a very careful forensic examination. And so this leaves us, you know, we're sort of in this, you know, one of these kind of classic murder mysteries where we're presented with a locked room and, you know, the dead body, and we have to sort of somehow look inside of this room and find, you know, the tiny clue that was left behind by the killer and figure out what actually happened. And so we're very much in the, you know, this is the sort of CSI kind of science, we're very much looking for very small fingerprints that will tip off what it was that was responsible for producing the early universe, or setting the initial conditions in the early universe. So as you know, this is the CMB spectrum. This is the WMAP 5 data, I think. I think I've included the new results. And so you can see there's this beautiful best fit. This is all something you've seen before between the data points on the one hand and the theoretical curve here. And it's notable that this theoretical curve has a lot of structure to it. In other words, if this was just a flat line and we were trying to, you know, fix its, you know, its slope and its amplitude, and we got that right, we'd probably pat ourselves on the back. But because you've got these beautiful acoustic peaks here as well, and because we can actually, you know, with just a few parameters, a few free parameters, we can draw a line and, you know, beautifully intersect the acoustic peaks, and likewise for the Akbar data that's at higher L here, it's clear that we have a model that we can have a reasonable degree of confidence in. And the reason that is that when you look at the free parameters that you adjust in order to fit that, there isn't actually a lot of physics in it, or there isn't a lot of kind of complicated physics in it. It's basically a kind of applied, you know, sort of various things that you learn in grad school. There's some statistical mechanics, there's the Boltzmann equation, essentially. There's some general relativistic perturbation theory, but there's probably nothing that Landau and Lipschitz couldn't have worked out in the 1940s. When it comes to figuring out what the CMB is actually doing, it's just that until we actually observed the CMB, no one was actually motivated to do the calculation, because it, you know, it's a lot of work, but there's no deep physics that we don't understand. This is a kind of, you know, applied calculation of stuff that's, you know, been well under control for quite some time. Certainly since, I guess, you know, once you have relativity and quantum mechanics, then you have everything you need to do, you know, to do this. We worry about the Boltzmann equation. We need to concern ourselves with the way that reionization works. We're, you know, looking at electrons that are moving in an inhomogeneous background, so you get this, you know, they see this, you know, inhomogeneous radiation, so that you get some polarization. But it's beautiful, but largely classical physics that we use to figure out what's going on in the CMB. The one point where kind of fundamental physics is really involved is that we have to actually figure out what the initial perturbations, you know, we just, you know, when you run one of these codes, you just put this in as an input, and you just, you know, you can just parameterize it however you want. But eventually the connection with sort of, you know, sort of very high energy gut scale physics is going to come from the fact that the perturbation spectrum that, you know, provides the seeds for what we see in the microwave background and also for the location of galaxies, eventually we, you know, if we're thinking about inflation, we're imagining these things starting out as, you know, quantum fluctuations in some primordial field very, very early on in the history of the universe, potentially when the energy was up near the gut scale. So we can do these calculations. You know, CAM runs on, you know, my laptop in a few seconds, and we can fit these cosmological parameters with data using, you know, Monte Carlo, Carlo Markov chain techniques. So this is a, you know, well understood process. And so then the question is, what do we learn from doing this? And so the key thing here is this is, you know, this is a table from the from Komatsu et al., one of the WMAP5 papers. And the key thing is not so much what the, you know, central values of these numbers are. You know, these are the free parameters that we fix in the chains, and these are the numbers that we calculate from the best fit. The key thing is not so much whether this number is 273 or 2.28. It's the fact that we have this huge, you know, each of these quantities has been measured to a, you know, very large number of significant figures, certainly compared, well, not very large, I mean 2 or 3. By cosmology standards, is a huge improvement on the factor of 2, for instance, that you would have seen in the Hubble constant maybe 25 years ago. And people used to debate whether the Hubble constant was 50 or 100, and now we can debate, you know, whether it's 72 or 74. So this is, you know, clearly a huge improvement. And what this means is that cosmology has, in some sense, graduated from the back of the envelope. You know, it used to be that you could do cosmology in the back of a small envelope, then, you know, somewhat bigger envelope. And now, you know, we really, if we want to do cosmology, we really have to be worried about doing our calculations that are accurate to, you know, sort of the 1% level, as opposed to the sort of, you know, treating pi as equal to 3. The problem is inside of this parameter set, which is unknown, there's only maybe 1 or 2 parameters that actually have something directly to do with inflation. In other words, if we want to constrain inflation, most of these parameters, in fact, refer to what's going on in the relatively late universe rather than the primordial universe. And so if we kind of look at, you know, this is this, these are the free parameters in our concordance cosmology. And so these are the things that would typically vary in order to figure out what, you know, what the universe is doing today. And so if you look at, you know, if any of these parameters, you know, what we're basically doing is quantifying our ignorance. So for instance, you know, the gravitational constant doesn't appear anywhere here because we've measured that somewhere else. So these are numbers that have not been measured in any other way, but we can estimate them from the, you know, from the CMB. So these two numbers here, this is the height of the spectrum of primordial perturbations. This is an amplitude. And this NS is the, that gives the scale dependence. And so the spectrum scales is K, you know, to the N, the NS minus 1. So when NS is exactly equal to 1, you have a spectrum that, you know, that has no dependence on the wave number. And this is generated by inflation, which we somehow think is, you know, associated with gut or maybe stringy physics. On the other hand, numbers like this, this is the baryon fraction. We know the mass of baryons, we just don't know how, the number of them necessarily. And we know that this is controlled by baryogenesis, but we don't know, really know how baryogenesis actually occurs. The dark matter, we know, we have very good reason for believing the dark matter is there. But again, we don't know the mass of the dark matter particle or, in fact, its number density. If we could measure one, obviously we'd know the other. Now, the cosmological constant, we have no clue at all, no clue about at all. That might as well be magic, but we can certainly measure the number that, that it corresponds to. And the reionization fraction, when the first stars turn on, the universe becomes ionized. And so we have this parameter tau that tells us when that happens, but this presumably depends on the details of nuclear physics and, you know, how the first stars behave. And, I mean, Katie has this model of, you know, decaying dark matter in early stars that powers the first stars. But as a general rule, we don't need to have something fundamental going on here. This is probably involves physics that we in some sense understand. It's just that we don't quite know how to do the calculation to make a prediction here. And the last number here is Hubble's constant, which of course is not a constant at all if you're a cosmologist. It's something that varies with time. And so if we did these, observations a couple of billion years earlier, we'd have got a different number for this quantity. So this isn't something that we can predict unless we know in advance how old the universe has to be. That's another way of writing this, the amplitude of this guy here. And so what we're left with is we've got these two parameters, just two numbers that are going to allow us to tell, you know, these are the numbers that necessarily tell us something about inflation. All of these other numbers here are telling us something about physics that probably doesn't have anything to do with inflation. I mean, maybe the baryogenesis and the mechanism for inflation are somehow related, but this certainly doesn't have to be the case. So we have to take this information and we have to try and figure out how inflation works. And so this is the first line of Anna Karenina, and I guess what Tolstoy is doing here is he's justifying the fact that he's going to write a long novel, probably, that's Russian, about an unhappy family, because he's basically saying, if I was writing a novel about a happy family, it would be boring.
And so we, on the other hand, as cosmologists, can look at the universe, and we're forced into this, this conclusion here, is that smooth universes are all pretty much the same as each other. Whereas every lumpy universe is lumpy in its own way. So when we look up into the sky, we're not interested in the fact that the universe is smooth on large scales, even though this is seen as a big success of inflation. If we want to tell one inflationary model from another, we have to look at the departures from smoothness, because any smooth universe is going to look like any other smooth universe, provided we keep the other parameters fixed. So the thing to look at is this density perturbation spectrum. And so this is just the formula that I sketched before. And as far as the data is concerned, we can fit the data perfectly well just with these two parameters. In other words, you can add further parameters where you have, you know, where this n now becomes a function of the wave number itself. But you've got no real motivation for doing so. If you look at, you know, whether your chi-squared degree of freedom or if you get fancier and use Bayesian evidence, there's no statistical test that says the data requires any number of parameters beyond this. From the point of view of inflation, we know that the perturbations are a function of the inflationary potential. In other words, if you give me an inflationary potential, then me or someone who's taking a graduate class from me or someone like me, will be able to tell you what this quantity n should be, both the constant value of n and also whatever scale dependence it might have, whatever higher order parameters you'd want to put in here. So cosmologically, we can have access to scales from sort of galaxy clustering scales through to the larger scale we can see in the microwave background, which is about from maybe 1 megaparsec through to 10,000 megaparsecs. But on the other hand, we know that the universe grows about 10 to the 30 times bigger, or at least 10 to the 30 times bigger during the observationally relevant piece of inflation. And so this 10 to the 4 that we have here, the fraction of the universe we actually, the fraction of the inflationary phase we can actually test is just this 10 to the 4 over 10 to the 30. So in some sort of logarithmic sense, we're just looking at sort of a little bit better than 10% of this total phase when we look at perturbations in the sky. So when we do that, because the field point is moving down the potential, it's clear that the CMB, when we look at the CMB, we're only sampling a small chunk of the inflationary potential. So if we want to do this inverse problem, there's necessarily going to be some extrapolation involved, because we're going to look at the potential over some small little region, and then we're going to try and extend our knowledge of the potential outside of that region. So there's got to be some theoretical input that lets us basically assume that the potential's smooth and doesn't suddenly start changing in some completely random way when we're not actually able to look at it. Proof that the universe wouldn't just be subtle, but would in fact be malicious. And so the mechanism by which these perturbations are generated, again, this is well understood, is we know that as the inflaton field rolls down its potential, we know that it also makes quantum fluctuations that mean on top of the semi-classical rolling, it's jittering backwards and forwards. And so we can calculate the amplitude of these fluctuations. Again, this is a relatively straightforward exercise. And because if you fluctuate a little bit up the hill, the universe is going to be a little bit denser than it would otherwise have been. And so these fluctuations in the field can be transformed very directly into density perturbations. We can parameterize both the motion of the fields and also the growth of the universe in terms of these slow roll parameters. So this is v prime over v squared, and I'm setting m Planck implicitly equal to unity here. Eta is v double prime over v, and you have a whole sequence of these things that involves higher order derivatives of the potential. And this ns minus 1 quantity in standard models of inflation is related to this combination of v prime and v double prime. And this is the lowest order. So there are higher order corrections, both that would involve epsilon squared, and also that would involve terms that have cubic and higher, third order and higher derivatives. And so this quantity is only barely different from unity in Wmap 5. This is 0.04 plus or minus 0.014. So this is now the sort of 2.5 sigma level, so we can be very happy, but on the other hand, this doesn't let us easily discriminate between competing models of inflation. All the main models of inflation, with a couple of exceptions, fit comfortably within this window. The other observable we can produce during inflation is the fact that we know that, as well as having these fluctuations in the scalar field, the space-time metric itself is free to fluctuate during this time, and these fluctuations become gravitational waves, and so they're tensor perturbations when we look at the metric, and they again have an amplitude relative to the scalar fluctuations that's equal to 16 times this epsilon parameter. So if we can measure these things, we can in some sense measure this epsilon parameter.
All models of inflation, NS has to be different from one, right?
And if you have De Sitter space, NS can be exactly equal to 1, or is exactly equal to 1, because the universe is just scale invariant, so clearly there can't be any time dependence. There's also a kind of funky model of inflation that you can cook up with a very special potential. By basically this is V double prime, this is V prime over V squared, this is V double prime, so you can actually say, well, what do I have to do to make these numbers exactly equal to 0, and just solve the differential equation and get a potential, which at least the first order and slow roll will actually give you something that's scale invariant. So there's a couple of the special models, but they're points of measure 0 in some sense in the parameter space. The one you get by doing this dynamically is kind of funky. De Sitter space is obviously something that's theoretically important. On the other hand, if you have slow roll inflation, because De Sitter space is precisely because De Sitter space is time invariant, then you can't bring inflation to an end in an organized way in De Sitter space unless you've got some other field that's evolving to give you a clock so that the universe knows. Because otherwise, you can end De Sitter space, De Sitter inflation locally, but you can't end it globally. And so, as far as slow roll inflation is concerned, we're implicitly ignoring De Sitter inflation when we do this.
Is a slow spectrum rather tilted?
Pardon? People use the phrase red or blue. If this quantity is less than 1, I may have missed out the over. Yeah, I think I've missed a. Well, there's a minus sign in here somewhere. So in fact, NS minus one is less than is in fact slightly less than unity, which means that wave numbers that are large, in other words, wavelengths that are short, have less power than wave numbers that are small, in other words, long wavelengths. And therefore, we have slightly less power in short wavelength modes than we have in long wavelength modes. And people refer to that as a red spectrum, simply because, not that these things have color, but simply because the longer wavelength modes are slightly dominant over the short wavelength modes. And so we do appear to have a reasonable amount of confidence at the moment that the spectrum of the primordial perturbations is in fact red. I should mention in passing that this number here is obtained by using the minimal number of parameters. And so if you put extra parameters into your fit, which could be non-zero but haven't been measured to be non-zero, then these bounds tend to get a little bit looser. So the claim that WMAP has confirmed that there is a red spectrum has a kind of theoretical prior in it. And for instance, that there really isn't any running in this quantity here. If you start to have to worry about higher order parameters, then the constraints become looser in such a way as that this quantity here actually overlaps better with zero than it does, obviously, for fit with a smaller number of parameters. So, yes, this is the absolute value in some sense, but it's meant to be negative, because NS is slightly less than 1, so NS minus 1 is slightly less than 0, so this should have a minus sign in front of it. My apologies. So the cartoon version of what's going on is, this is our standard inflationary potential. These are the this is the chunk of the potential that the inflaton field's moving through as the perturbations are laid down. The CMB scales are sort of more up in this region here, because the longer scales are generated earlier than the short scales. And so we look at, say, galaxy clustering statistics, we're looking down into this region here. But because the whole potential is given by this shape here, if we can just do observations about this region here, then clearly there's some extrapolation involved in moving outside of this region. So this is an old problem. Can we recover, once we've observed the perturbations, can we recover the potential? And this is the first paper, this is one of the first papers that really talks about this in a lot of detail. You can find precursors back a couple of years earlier than that. And what Haranya Pierce and I would claim is that in principle you can do this. Obviously you have to make some assumptions in order to solve this inverse problem. But given the assumptions that we're going to make, we believe that we have an optimal algorithm for doing this. In other words, we're not throwing away any data. We're not making any approximations we don't need to make. So in that sense, given we're using all the information we have to hand, it would be impossible, given the same amount of information, to do a better job than the one that we're doing. And what we can do is we take two different pieces of information. One, we take the perturbation spectrum, which is obviously what we see on the sky. But the other thing we know is that inflation, we have constraints on the duration of inflation. And if inflation doesn't last at least 50 e-folds for cup-scale inflation, we know that we don't have a working model of inflation. So if we choose a set of epsilon and eight, these slow roll parameters, and then we extrapolate the rest of the shape of the potential from that, we can look at that and see when will inflation come to an end. And if it turns out that inflation is going to come to an end, 10 e-folds after we've generated the CMB, then it's clear that we don't have a viable inflationary model. And because what I'm going to tell you we're going to do is we're going to fit not to this NS parameter, which is purely empirical, but we're actually going to fit directly to the slow roll parameters. In other words, we're going to take the slow roll parameters, which are related to whatever the physics is that generates inflation.
We're going to put those parameters in our cosmological data set, and then we're going to run Markov chains that, you know, writes, you know, that works out what the, you know, constraints are on this parameter space. And so if we have some set of parameters that for some theoretical reason we can work out doesn't produce a realistic model of inflation, then we can rule those out in the fitting stage rather than at some later point. And because if you just fit to NS, you don't know a priori what the slow roll parameters that produced it were, you can't do this process if you're fitting to the sort of this empirical characterization of the power spectrum. So we're taking these quantities that are somehow related to fundamental physics because you've got the derivatives of the inflaton potential, and we're putting them directly inside of our astrophysical parameter set. So when we do that, we're assuming that inflation happened, we're assuming that, you know, there's an inflationary origin to the density perturbations, and then we can constrain these parameters, and once we've constrained these parameters, obviously then we can, you know, in a sense, reconstruct a Taylor series for the potential. The way we do this is we take, as I said, we assume single field inflation, we assume that it's minimally coupled, in other words, it doesn't have any funky couplings to gravity, and we assume that the model can be specified entirely via the functional form of the potential, has a minimal kinetic term. So this is slow roll inflation, so this was introduced in the early 1980s, and the nice way to look at this is using what's called the Hamilton-Jacobi formalism. So this is purely a mathematical thing, it's a rewriting of the system of equations, there's no new physics in it. And what you do is you use the inflaton field itself as a clock, so you know that the inflaton field is moving, and therefore you can write down the same dynamical system, but using phi, the inflaton field value, as your free parameter. The advantage to doing this, I'm just writing down these equations here, so this is just essentially the second Friedman equation, this is the A double prime over A equation, these primes are with, you know, with, so you're writing the Hubble parameter as a function of phi. No, because phi is, you know, it's the only thing that's changing. This is an exact equation for the velocity of the field. So once you have phi dot, you can know whatever you have, you know, once you've got d phi dt, you can take whatever dynamical system you have and you can rewrite all your time derivatives in terms of derivatives with respect to the field. This is essentially the Hubble's equation, or the, no, this is the h squared equals rho equation, so this is again exact. This is simply a definition. This is the definition of the epsilon parameter, but now instead of V prime over V, we have H prime over H, and various constants have changed. And this is just a rewriting of these equations here. Hang on a minute. I'm going to have to go through this whole rigmarole again. I'm sorry. So this tells us that once we've measured these quantities, we then have an algebraic formula that gives us the form of the potential. So if we specify a bunch of free parameters that allow us to measure this H, then we can always figure out the potential, and once we've figured that out, then we can always figure out the inflationary dynamics that that potential would imply.
So
it's actually exact, in the sense that you're not assuming slow roll. So the key thing is that Hamilton-Jacobi is an exact rewriting of the full non-slow roll dynamics of inflation. You have a problem when you start to talk about oscillations because then the field isn't monotonic, and so in any given oscillation, obviously you're fine. But if you wouldn't normally use this to describe the oscillation simply because you've lost the monotonicity of your time.
But when you're actually doing the same calculation,
exactly.
Then you don't care about oscillations.
You don't care about the oscillations, and in principle, you could do it piecewise. It's just that you wouldn't. I mean, it would be silly. But for what we're doing, we haven't. The key thing is that this is an exact rewriting of the dynamics of a single minimum. You know, this is another way of writing the Klein-Gordon equation in an expanding universe. Nothing has been thrown away. No, exactly, exactly. I actually think that was the original motivation for this. So this rewriting of the inflationary dynamics goes back at least, I think, to Bond and Salopek, maybe. So late 1980s, early 1990s. It's not certainly nothing that I personally would claim to. Yeah. No, the key thing about it, which wasn't so well appreciated until later on, and this is one of these things that, you know, you can't imagine why people who saw this thing written down years ago didn't immediately see, but when you do see it, you can write these so-called higher-order slow-roll parameters. So this, you know, L equals 1 here gives you this eta parameter. This gives you the xi parameter, which is, you know, got a V triple prime in it in some sense. You can just define these objects here. And so this is, again, just a matter of definition. But then you can write down a system of differential equations that tells you how each of these parameters depends on the other ones. Steve? No, we're not. This is now the sort of late 90s as opposed to the early 90s. But I'll tell you exactly what it was that Haranya and I did. These are just the definition of these lambda parameters. So you have this whole sequence of, you know, this whole potentially infinite sequence of these parameters. And the key thing is you can then write down
a set of differential equations that these guys obey. And so I've rewritten my variable again. I've actually rewritten this with respect to n. So this is now the logarithm of the expansion of the universe. So it's now the number of e-folds is the jargon that cosmologists like to use. And you have this sequence of equations here. And what you see is that each of these equations is sourced by epsilon and eta, and also the one that's kind of one, the term that's one bigger in the expansion than the one that you're considering. So here's, this is lambda 2, and it's sourced by lambda 3 itself, and then this epsilon eta piece, and these equations are nonlinear. But if I say at some point that above some critical value of L, that all of these lambdas are zero, then this, what happens is that this equation, if I truncate this hierarchy, then at some initial point, this truncation lasts for all of time. And so what we have now is a closed system that we don't know. Once we've truncated it, if I tell you that V prime is one of the derivatives of the potential is zero at some point, I don't necessarily have a guarantee that all of those derivatives are zero at some higher order point. But because you have this nice closure relationship, once you've specified the initial value of all of these things, then you've got the full inflationary trajectory. And then you can say, I can have classes of models that simply depend on the number of parameters that I'm including in my set. And even if I had some magical value, where most of these numbers were zero, provided the dynamics in the end is going to be set by whatever the largest value of L is that you allow to, whichever one of these you allow to be non-zero.
What does it mean?
And what you're doing is essentially you're saying that there's no very sharp changes in the inflationary potential. There's no very sharp changes. And in some sense it's analogous to a Taylor expansion. It's not exactly analogous, but it's similar enough. You can certainly think of it as a Taylor expansion of the potential. It's not exactly one, but it's very close. It is in fact a Taylor expansion of H as a function of the Hubble parameter as a function of phi. It's exactly a Taylor expansion. In fact, someone wrote a paper recently where they actually said, what happens if we Taylor expand H as a function of phi? And I don't think they realized that what they'd actually done was what people had been doing in this area for some time. I mean, they sort of knew it, but they didn't realize that it was exactly equivalent, I don't think. So as I said, we've made these assumptions, and then we're in a position, we take the initial values, therefore, some set of these slow roll parameters, truncated at some order. We take these numbers, we put them into our cosmological parameter set, then we run chains and we can estimate these numbers, and then we can look at whether or not we have meaningful numbers for the potential. In fact, you can also actually solve this truncated hierarchy exactly. That's a kind of minor point. It's a point of interest. We actually use this exact solution inside of our numerics because we have no analytic expression for what the fields are doing. Those initial values are chosen by the data. In other words, we choose, we specify some large initial spread. We draw numbers from a flat prior, so exactly the same way as you'd constrain any other fundamental parameter. So in other words, the whole point is this is in fact one of the things that, to answer the question that came up before, this is one of the things that we've done. People knew about this dynamical system, and they knew about how to fit cosmological parameters with Markov chains, but what Horadio and I did essentially was to take these two realizations and to join them together. Previously, people had done this kind of thing, but they'd always calculated NS, and then they'd sudden done a kind of post-processing fit. And when you do that, when you calculate, when you fit to NS, you're throwing away the information that you know about the duration of inflation. Because we have an expression now for the whole potential, we can look at that potential and see, was there enough inflation after we laid down the cosmological modes in order for this to be a viable model, and we can apply that cut at the time that we run the chain. And so because we know that, but once we specify these parameters, we know the potential, and because we know the potential, we can then look at that inflationary model and say, is that inflationary model in fact a reasonable one? So what we're doing, so when we actually constrain these numbers, we're constraining them with data. And so, we, in the same way that you can measure, you can constrain NS and A, these empirical parameters, using Markov chains, we're using Markov chains now to constrain these slow roll parameters. Yeah, so in other words, we're using the data to tell us what these numbers are, and these numbers are somehow related to fundamental physics in ways that obviously we don't fully understand. Mm-hmm. Well, but that's the same as any other situation. I mean, this empirical, this NS is in fact, you know, the first order expansion and a similar expansion. And so in the end, the number of parameters that you include is obviously guided by the data. If you add another parameter and your fit doesn't get better, then that's telling you that parameter, you know, you've got no control over that parameter on the basis of data. And everything that you know about it is just, you know, just from theory. And so we can consistently add to the number of parameters that we're considering and see whether each addition of parameters, in fact, improves our chi-squared pedigree of freedom. So in that sense, the one additional input that we make here is that we can run these chains with different assumptions for the truncation that we've done, and we can see whether or not that improves our fit. So and again, the order of the truncation in the end is guided by data. Let me get to that. Let me get to that. So let's just cut this. So what we're doing in the end is this algorithm around here I call slow roll reconstruction. And so we're taking our priors and our parameter choices. We take some data, and then we can very quickly work out we get parameters that are related to the shape of the potential, and then we can look at that potential and we can say, does this correspond uniquely to some inflationary model? Whereas what you do if you have an inflationary model, obviously you start here and you work your way down. These are from chains that we've been running on the WMAP5 data. These are still a little messy. We're still working on understanding them properly. But what we have here is the blue lines here correspond to WMAP only. The red lines correspond to a fit to WMAP plus supernovae data. And this parameter region here corresponds to a fit that's done to the NS variables. This by here corresponds to models where inflation doesn't last long enough relative to some assumptions about the way that reheating works. And you can see that we have a slightly, this is a two-parameter fit. This is just the epsilon and eta case. And you can see we have a slightly different fit from the WMAP case, but it's essentially not radically different from what we saw before. And what we've done is we've fitted to the slow roll parameters, but then we've converted that into the predictions for the tensor scalar ratio R and the NS that we'd see at a pivot of 0.2 inverse megaparsecs. So likewise, we can do this for... Now these are the same parameters for the actual slow roll parameters themselves. But when it becomes interesting is when we start to fit when we add a third order parameter, this so-called Xi parameter. And these dashed lines here are the fits you get if you just look at this DNSD log K, this running in the spectral index, and these are the fits that you'd get from the WMAP chains. Whereas these are the fits we get from our algorithm, and the extra bite here is coming from the fact that models that would live in this space down here, which are allowed as long as you just consider this number, actually turn out to produce, in this case, too short a period of inflation, because this V triple prime number very quickly means that the potential becomes too steep to support inflation if you're down in this region. Whereas in this region here, this black line here corresponds to a cut that also eliminates models that would overproduce primordial black holes or would actually produce a very large density perturbation before inflation had come to an end. So again, we have another cut that sort of basically rules out large values of this running, and you can see that we now have shape of the likelihood has changed, so we've got this region that would be excluded by WMAP, but we have a much tighter constraint on this parameter simply because we can put in these extra theoretical priors that aren't available if you're fitting to this purely empirical characterization of the data. So this is work that we're still finishing, but it certainly gives an idea as to kind of the extra theoretical power they were bringing to bear here is basically telling us that we can't have a model that lives in this region because that wouldn't correspond to a viable model of inflation. The last thing I want to say is that this process, because the slow roll parameters involve, we know that there's information in the evolution which is ignored in standard fits. In other words, epsilon itself is a function of time, so if we specify epsilon and eta, we know that the spectral index, in fact, has to be a function of k. It turns out, I've just done some calculations with my grad student, Peter Adsed, and we showed, in fact, with some help from Lecture, who helped us with the Fisher matrix code that we wrote, we know that there isn't enough leverage, essentially, in the range of k values that you probe with the CMB for us to be able to use the CMB data alone to take advantage of this running. On the other hand, if you look at high redshift 21 centimeter, which probes the spectrum at scales that are much smaller than the CMB, then you have a much longer lever arm. And we believe that on these scales, we would in fact be able to observe the intrinsic running, and that obviously gives you a much tighter bite on the inflationary parameter space, even before you start to apply these theoretical cuts that are related to the total duration of inflation. So that's something we're trying to sharpen up at the moment. We'll have a paper out on that over the summer.
The next thing I wanted to talk about, if I have a little bit of time left, is the production of gravitational waves by inflation. So this is one thing. Now, this density perturbations are just one fingerprint. So we know that inflation produces quite intensive fluctuations at very large scales. We know that these things don't seed structure. They're always produced by inflation, but the amplitude of these things decreases with inflationary scale. So if I have a stringy model, many of which will like to have inflation happening at maybe 10 to the 12 GeV, the amplitude of these tensor modes is unobservably small. Like no conceivable experiment pretty much would be able to detect them. So while they can be there, they're not, it's not guaranteed that they will be there. But if we were to observe these things in an experiment like BBO, the sort of cartoon is, you know, now we're observing these things at solar system scales, not galaxy scales. So we're observing them in this, you know, something in this region of the potential down here. These things are related to V and V prime, so you'd get this much longer lever arm if you could actually observe these things, or alternatively, you know, put a tight constraint on our amplitude. You'd then get this extra constraint on the shape of the potential from this. And again, if we had this information from BBO, assuming 20 years from now, it would be a simple matter for us to include this in the algorithm that we've written. It naturally would take information from any set of scales. Big Bang Observer. It's kind of a successor to LISA, and it's tuned to go after the primordial gravitational wave spectrum from inflation. But the other thing I've been thinking about recently is we know that inflation has to come to an end at some point. And I'm having trouble with my keynote at the moment, so I haven't been able to put the movie in here, but we know that the universe has to reheat. And so the reheating phase, you know, you imagine the inflaton sloshing around the bottom of its potential. And as it does that, you can have two ways of generating particles, one of which is just, you know, through tree-level interactions between the inflaton and something else. And we know that those interactions have to be weak because we know that the inflaton should be weakly coupled to everything else in order to not to mess up its potential. On the other hand, there's this process, parametric resonance, which means that you can take the momentum modes of some other field, and the oscillating inflaton acts like will resonantly produce some of these momentum modes. So you have momentum modes of some other field that have been produced, you know, exponentially rapidly. So you have something like stimulated emission in the early universe. And in this case, the reheating process can be essentially instantaneous and leads to a, you know, very explosive growth of the occupation number of some fields. These are, you know, obviously then, you know, once you've done that, you have very large spatial fluctuations, and they're at very small co-moving scales. So if inflation ends at the TeV scale, that would correspond to about 10 to the 6 kilometers in the universe, in other words, about a million kilometers. Whereas if it ends at the GeV scale, you're looking at a scale of about 1 centimeter. So obviously we're talking about gravitational wave experiments, where LIGO falls somewhere in the middle of this thing, logarithmically. But we're now looking at the shape of the potential down here, and we're looking in particular at the couplings of the inflaton to other fields.
Can you also talk
about this? I'm going to get there in a second. Yeah. So this is just saying that there's this mechanism. This is the sort of gravitational waves you'd get after a phase transition. It's not the quantum generated gravitational waves that you think of as coming from inflation. I've got a picture in a second. Give me a second. So this is, in fact, how you run... this is an example of parametric resonance. Now, these things, they have them in science centers. This is a huge block of concrete that has a piece of metal wrapped around it, and this kid's been given a fridge magnet. And by tugging just very gently on the fridge magnet at the right frequency, you can send this huge block of concrete to moving. And so this an example of a force tuned... forcing this oscillator here, and parametric resonance works in the same way, that you have this benign looking equation that gives you this explosive growth of structure in the early universe. And so I'm just going to drop out of my thing here, and I'm going to see if I can pull up my movie. Yeah. We haven't done that's a picture of my kid. That's not going to do any good. Hang on a minute. Sorry, my screen has changed by moving to this the shape, this thing here, so I can't now see my here we go, let's try this. Sorry about this, folks, this is extremely unprofessional. And where is full screen? Here we go. Okay, so this is what's happening. This is the phi field that oscillates backwards and forwards. And so this is a slice through a box. So these are done with numerical simulations because we're talking about nonlinear physics here. And in this chi field, the individual momentum modes are pumped up. So they acquire, they were initially zero, they acquire a substantial amplitude, and then eventually they feed back into the phi field. So we're solving the fully nonlinear coupled Klein-Gordon equations for these two fields.
So that's a numerical, I mean, so all I want to say is we've been doing, like, heavy-duty numerical simulations in order to figure out what's going here. We calculate the corresponding pieces of the energy-momentum tensor, and then we can compute the gravitational wave spectrum that's generated by this process.
What's chi?
Chi is just some other other representative scalar field that the inflaton field is assumed to be coupled to by some.
But in your previous model, you had
only
single.
The inflaton field is a single field. The chi field has a big mass, so it doesn't move during inflation. And then at the end of inflation, there's a phi squared chi squared coupling that's on the order of 10 to the minus 5 or something like that. You write down the mode equations for the momentum modes of the chi field, and then the phi field that's in the potential gives you that's oscillating backwards and forwards, so it acts like a time-dependent a harmonic forcing term. And that harmonic forcing term then drives these modes. Well, the inflaton has to be coupled to something because we need to make, somehow or other, we need to make particles once inflation's over because, the universe is not now dominated by a coherently oscillating scalar field. And so the chi field serves as a kind of proxy for whatever the coupling is. And it turns out you can couple to, particles with spin and so forth. If you have string theory, you would reasonably expect that the scalar would be coupled to something else. So it's just a generic, it's a complete toy model. Okay? But we think that its properties are reasonably generic.
But chi field also
Yes, exactly. In principle, you could couple the inflaton to particles that were more directly coupled to the standard model. But it's convenient to do this for two scalar fields, at least as a kind of warm-up problem. This is happening at very high scales, so you're probably not producing pure standard model states. You're probably producing states at sort of some much higher scale, and eventually those things would decay into standard. Now these would be states that would be in whatever the extension to the ultraviolet completion of the standard model is. You're not necessarily producing quarks and photons with the same direct. So the key thing is that we produce the signal. This is just an inhomogeneous matter distribution. And the signal is very model dependent, but you can work out that you get a maximum amount of 10 to the minus 5 of the total density of the universe can be converted into gravitational waves. This is a fairly generic number, and you see it in sort of gravitational wave production from bubble collisions during phase transitions as well. So this gives us an upper bound on how big this signal can be, and because we're producing these gravitational waves during the radiation-dominated era, their total mass fraction just scales with the rest of the universe. They're not diluted as the universe grows because gravity waves are just radiation. So they scale. This fraction stays constant until you have matter radiation equality, and then you get an extra factor of dilution factor of about 10 to the 5. That's coming from the fact that after matter radiation equality, the universe has got about 10 to the 5 times bigger. That means that any radiation you have will be diluted by this factor relative to the matter in the universe. So we can work out the transfer function, and what we learn is that this signal can live somewhere inside of this box here. And you can see that if we compare this to various representative experiments, you can see that advanced LIGO, for instance, samples this tiny fraction of this box. But actually, this would be the first experiment I'm aware of that would actually have some hope of actually directly probing even a tiny portion of this region. Yeah, but the problem is this is a plot of omega GW, and so the constant omega GW, you need to have a strain sensitivity that rises as the frequency cubed of the gravitational wave detector. So these guys, you need just a strain sensitivity that's just eye-poppingly strong in order to see a stochastic background at sort of gigahertz scales. On the other hand, you can see that BBO, which is designed to do something else, this Big Bang Observer, it takes a huge bite out of this parameter space. But it's taking a bite out of the parameter space that corresponds to inflation that's happened at really relatively low scales. So we're talking TeV through maybe to 10 to the 9th GeV, whereas your typical gut scale inflationary model is sitting up here somewhere. And the reason for the scaling is very easy to understand. If you have inflation ending at 10 to the 15 GeV and the universe thermalizes, then the universe has grown a lot more between that, the temperature of 10 to the 15 GeV in the present than it would do if inflation ends at, say, 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 GeV. And in that case, it means that a co-moving scale that corresponds to the size of the universe at the end of inflation is therefore scales inversely with the temperature at the end of inflation. So it just pushes this peak down to redder and redder scales. The cool thing about this is that
we know that the primordial signal of gravitational waves gets harder to see as the inflationary scale drops. Because of this dependence on the strain sensitivity of the detector, this signal actually, if it's there, will get easier to see as the amplitude of the primordial signal drops. So in some sense, you're not guaranteed to have the signal. You can certainly come up with inflationary models where it's not generated in a substantial way. But on the other hand, if you do have the signal, this is actually something that from an experimental point of view, would be easier to detect in a low scale model. And so something like BBO then gives a second window to an entirely different class of inflationary models. And certainly models that, on the one hand, this depends on the way that the inflaton couples to everything else. And because we don't have a good theory of inflation, we certainly don't have a good theory of what the couplings of the inflaton are to other matter. On the other hand, you certainly see this parametric resonance without adding a great, you don't have to add something to the theory in order to make it happen. Models that people had written down in the 80s were realized in the 90s to generate parametric resonance. So it's not something you have to tune your model in order to generate this mechanism. So it's certainly a very interesting potential target for gravitational wave experimentation. So it's something that's probably good to mention in a room at Penn State. And the key thing is also this is a hard calculation. To really do it in a meaningful way, you've got to do numerical simulations. But there's at least three other groups that I'm aware of that are working in this area at the moment. And there was an original paper in this area by Klebnikov and Kachev in 1997, and then this was revisited in a meaningful way by me and my postdoc Eugene Lim a couple of years ago. And so my group at Yale has put together a code to do this, and since then our results have been confirmed by a group that's based at CETA with Lev Kaufman and Gary Felder and Defoe and a couple of other people, and also a group in Spain, Juan García Bolido and graduate students, I think, are working on this as well. And I'm aware of at least one more group that's been in touch with us, and they've got a code. And I sort of heard through the grapevine of a fourth group that's also working on this. So in order to do this in a meaningful way, you have to do these full-scale numerical simulations. But these are relatively well understood, but it's certainly good that because you're taking these simulations and then you're differentiating the fields in order to compute the gravitational wave spectrum, it's good that we can all agree with each other because it's a very non-trivial calculation. I'm not going to talk about non-Gaussianity at all because I think I'm running out of time, other than to say that I've been thinking hard about how to calculate the non-Gaussianity in non-trivial models of inflation. So a standard slow roll model of inflation produces a very small non-Gaussianity. So if you measure a primordial non-Gaussianity that you think was laid down with the initial conditions, you can rule out almost any model of inflation you learned about in high school. Let's just cut past that. But it's also true that the constraints on non-Gaussianity are getting a lot tighter with time. So I just wanted to wind up and say that at the moment, we're not at the point where data picks out a specific inflationary model. But we're learning now, I think, that inflationary phenomenology is a very rich science. It certainly goes way beyond the way that we can think about inflation just by looking at the spectral index and the amplitude. There's many other fingerprints that we can look for, but all of these fingerprints are necessarily going to be tiny in some sense relative to the perturbations that we've observed. So we know that these things have to be there. We don't know how many parameters fit the spectrum. We could see scale dependence in the spectrum. We want to test the Gaussianity. All of these things, there's no guarantee that inflation produces non-trivial signal in any of these areas, but every time you come up with some new fingerprint that's characteristic of some class of inflationary models, then you can put extra cuts on an inflationary parameter space. And so this is what's guiding my thinking at the moment in terms of cuts that would be would be implementable in stuff that may now be on the experiments now on the drawing board. So I think what we can say more generally is that we're now really seeing, with this slow roll reconstruction in particular, I think we're now sort of making good on the promise that people have been making for years, that we can turn the early universe into a lab for high energy physics. And there are actually directly, in an absolutely direct and concrete way, we're taking astrophysical data, we're taking data that's gathered from the CMB and from the supernova results and from large scale structure, and we're using those to put constraints on parameters that are actually physical parameters that are directly related potentially to gut scale physics. So whenever we draw a parameter ellipsoid on this epsilon and eta parameter, this potential could be something that's going on at the gut scale, and we can tell you what these parameters are allowed to be. The other thing to think about, although I haven't talked about, is whether we can think about characteristics of stringy models that in some sense are characteristics of classes of stringy models. In other words, we can deal with the idea of the landscape that we have And if we can find the common threads that run through large classes of stringy models, then we could go and, you know, look for those in the universe. Certainly taking any single stringy model and comparing it with what we see on the sky is kind of a losing game, because we know that there are probably, you know, 10 to the 500 of them. And I think in 5 years' time, I think the rate at which the data is improving, it's clear that the constraints that we can put on inflationary parameters are going to be much tighter than they are now, which means that most now this is a great time to be generating inflationary models in some sense, because 5 years from now, most models you can think of will be dead on arrival, whereas now you can write down a model and you can have some reasonable confidence that it will be testable in the near future. So I think this is a rich time for inflationary phenomenology, and that would be where I'd end up. And so you're going to do it in front of a room full of people? Thanks.
So, unfortunately, a philosophical question. So, the question is, some people think the genericity of, you know, inflationary models is the only thing against inflation itself, or the theories that bring down inflation. Some people think, no, that's actually different because, you know, inflation is a big thing. It's a huge idea.
I think it depends on whether it's an odd numbered or an even numbered day. But I think to put that more concretely, I mean, I think it would be nice if we could see a minimal model of inflation that made sense with everything we see in physics. And you could see that. You could say, well, the simplest potential you could write down that has any structure to it would be something like m squared phi squared. Now, if you write down an exponential potential, inflation never comes to an end. But an m squared phi squared, there's naturally a point at which inflation comes to an end, you get a nice oscillation. The problem is if you go looking for m squared phi squared in the context of anything to do with particle physics, you find that you're working at a VEV that's greater than the Planck scale. And so there's a kind of interesting thing. If you have someone who grew up as a cosmologist and sort of listened to certain senior people in the field, they're told not to worry about that because Trans-Planckian VEVs, all you worry about is a Trans-Planckian energy density, and you're thinking about, you know, curvature corrections. Whereas if you're a field theorist or a string theorist, you look at effective field theory, you think, well, you know, there's going to be suppressed Planck scale interactions, that as long as my VEV is, there'll be stuff like, phi to the 6 over m Planck squared, and as soon as phi, times some constant of order unity, so as soon as the field gets bigger than the Planck scale, obviously I have, corrections that I don't understand and I can't control. And I think, I think that's a reason, in a sense, why we don't have a clean particle physics implementation for inflation, and the simplest algebraic models we can write down don't fit neatly into our understanding of high-energy physics. That said, the fact that we can think of 20 or 30 different ways of implementing inflation tells us that the mechanism itself isn't inherently fragile. It's not like we've only got one way of doing it, and we've got to tune, two numbers to be, equal to each other in parts and 10 to the 5 or something, or worse. So in that sense, the fact that we can think of lots of models of inflation is at least encouraging that the real universe worked this way. My kind of hunch, in some sense, it's very easy for the inflaton field to be imagined not as a fundamental field that lives somewhere in a Lagrangian or some theory, but as something that arises as an effective degree of freedom once you've done some appropriate coordinate transformation, like these assisted inflation models, for instance, where the inflaton field is actually a coherent. It's actually composed as a kind of coherent mode of many, many individual fields, and you observe something that looks like a fundamental scalar. Very similar. I mean, in the end, you get something that looks like m squared phi squared, for instance. So the constraints on those are very similar to the constraints that we construct this way. So in that sense, I think that it may be that, even if you had a theory that did support inflation, you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell that simply by looking at Lagrangian. Whereas I think 15 years ago, the hope was someone would write down some grand unified theory, you'd look at the scalar sector of that theory, and lo and behold, you'd find the one magical field that was going to have 10 to the minus, lambda phi fourth, lambda of 10 to the minus 14, and that would be your inflaton, and you'd have solved the problem. And I don't think the universe is going to be that kind to us.
I have one question. So I don't know what the status of sort of quantum-corrected, loop quantum-corrected cosmology versus inflation that you get. So that's what I've heard. Have people actually picked that to grindstone of like the type of analysis?
I'm the wrong person to ask.
Are those models amenable to self-analysis?
Well, did loop cosmology models have free parameters in them, I guess would be the question.
Because the statement is, the two issues, right? First is that one can say that, well, there is no inflationary potential in
Luke Bonham cosmology, I mean. Yeah.
That's first paradox. Then there is nonetheless a superinflation phase, but that superinflation phase is lasted up to keep enough to keep things. But still, as a mechanism, it's interesting and also see the fact.
No, I think that's, I mean, there's no guarantee. I mean, all of everything I said is, you know, contingent on the fact that something like inflation, or at least something that can be written as an inflationary model. So you know, just what you see, you know, for instance, ekpyrosis doesn't look like inflation, and yet many of the things that you'd say about ekpyrosis would apply directly to what I'm saying here, simply because there's a duel between these ekpyrite models of the, you know, contracting phase and then passes through some minima and then expands. You know, in some sense, that's dual to inflation. So you could transfer, you know, you could do the same process, but for an for ekpyrite models. The key thing is to say whether or not the model that you're looking at has free parameters. And so the other relevant thing is, you know, loop quantum gravity is something that you'd think of as happening, you know, when quantum corrections to gravity become significant. Because we know what the because the amplitude of the tensor modes in the CMB are directly proportional to the density scale, you know, the energy density of the universe during inflation, and that can't be significantly higher than the gut scale. So if we have this intuition that, you know, that quantum gravity is something that happens at the Planck scale, then the energy density of the universe is significantly sub-Planckian at the point where inflation must happen. And then if it wasn't, we'd have seen the tensor modes already. And so the more we constrain the tensor modes, the bigger a gap we're putting between the Planck scale and the not just the gut scale, but potentially below. And so I think if you wanted to do inflation with loop quantum gravity, then you might be able to explain sort of the initial state of the universe. You know, if you wanted to, say, take some quantum soup and then prepare that into some initial state. But then you'd want a second period of inflation that would actually be the one that was responsible for laying down the universe we actually see. And I think that in that sense, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect to see astrophysical perturbations being laid down by something that only knew about the Planck scale. I think whatever the physics is that lays down these perturbations has to know about some lower scale in a fundamental way.
So supposing one actually did the second part,
then you, well, in principle, you know, that would be the sort of thing you'd go after. You'd say, you know, is there a, you know, does the calculation we do with the perturbation spectrum, is that modified by trans-Planckian corrections? That the loop quantum gravity people should be able to calculate. I mean, in fact, I've said this to Lee. I don't know if I've said this elsewhere, but I said, you know, like, in principle, this is probably the one thing that you can calculate that we can actually see. Because you can't probe the Planck energy, because, you know, we know that these things happen, but you can probe the Planck length. I mean, inflation does do that. No, I mean, I think that's a very worthwhile activity. I mean, I think that's, you know, in principle, at least, you could make a prediction.
So, therefore, I mean, coming from, not taking the particle physics part of things, but just taking the cosmology part of things, as you're saying, not worrying about Planck scales as a...
I tend to take the particle physics point of view. That's why I'm nervous about N squared, Phi squared, because I think that that...
Okay, but let me just take the cosmological point of view for our understanding. Then, that is to say, this N squared, Phi squared, would potentially cure the... Mm-hmm. So you might get it, say, for example, add two more parameters.
Yeah, I understand.
Or three more parameters. Then what are the constraints that you're getting from the simulations and everything that comes and the...
At the moment, the lambda 5/4 model is ruled out already by data because it produces too high of potential. The m squared phi squared model will be, well, we can't rule it out any tighter because in the end, if all we look at is CMB data, then what we've really done is to rewrite this spectral index and the tensor mode. We've just basically done a linear rotation in that parameter space. It's only at the point where we're either sensitive to the duration of inflation, which we see when we look at the V triple prime parameter, which is small in most inflationary models people have written down, or alternatively...
So this
algorithm won't really come into its own until the point where we have information that's sensitive not just to the values, absolute values of the parameters at some point, but also to their evolution. And so I think to really do this properly, I think we need data from high reach of 21 centimeter information, which would be something we'd have, you know, maybe 10, 15 years from now. And then I think we could make a case that we could then put tighter constraints on the, if we had a two-parameter model, we could put tighter constraints on those parameters because we know how those parameters should be changing as a function of scale, and we should be able to see that change in the data. But at the moment, those parameters are small enough so that because these changes go as the square of these parameters, there's just no way that we can show theoretically that there's just not enough information in the CMB to be able to pull that information out and use it in a meaningful way. We're just beaten by cosmic variance.
So at the moment, basically,
We can't rule out n squared phi squared or lambda phi fourth any better. What we can do is we can look at models with a substantial running, and we can say that even though the data would allow this range, you're actually only allowed to have this range, and that's simply because you want to be consistent with it.
The running is for what?
The running of the spectral index. So people call it a running, but what they're talking about is so you write down k to the n minus 1, and then you say, well, k, this is actually this minus 1. And so you actually Taylor expand this n here. And so, this n, if you just write this down as a constant, you're taking just the zeroth part of this. And so what people write is dn of k, d log k, which they typically have written as this alpha parameter. And this thing is then evaluated, and obviously at some fiducial scale, which is known as the pivot. And so, you evaluate this thing at the pivot, and you've evaluated this thing at the pivot, and then you have the first two terms in this expansion.
Let me remark that if the quartic potential is indeed excluded, but only in the case of pure Einstein inverse gravity, if you consider a brain world that is still locked.
No, I agree completely.
It's the ground-dependent statement.
Well, no, I think this statement, for instance, that as I said before, the statement that n has been conclusively measured to be less than 1, or 2.5 sigma, that again is dependent on the number of parameters you put in your parameter set. If you put more parameters in the parameter set generically, you expect the ellipses become bigger, and then suddenly n of 1 becomes allowed again.
But in the Bremer phase, you don't really add the extra parameters, because if you consider some effective Friedman equation, simplified to the bone, right? You just have different between the energy density and the Hubble problem.
No, I agree, but you're talking your physical interpretation of the lambda phi 4 is different, because you're seeing that the physical system that you've written down is different, and obviously the physical predictions that it's making are different.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so it's not the, I'm actually thinking about this at the moment, partly because I somewhat rashly volunteered to give a talk at a neutrino conference later this month. I mean, one of the interesting things about inflation about cosmology is if you look at this concordance parameter set, as we measure the universe better and better, parameters are going to move into this parameter set that aren't there now. So Planck, for instance, does have to worry about the neutrino background, because that actually changes the CMB. The neutrinos don't tell you anything about inflation, because this is physics that's happening. You see this, a massive neutrino changes the way that the Sachs-Wolfe effect works, so you change the low L tail of the model, and you also mess with the acoustic oscillations a little bit, so the high L piece changes. And so depending on the mass of the neutrino that you're looking at, what you assume is the mass of the neutrino, and depending on how good your experiment is, whether you have really good resolution of the Doppler peaks, and also if you're including information from structure formation, where you can again see slight mass to the neutrino, what that will do is it will allow you to remove some of the if you didn't know the mass of the neutrino and you hadn't measured that, then you'd have to put that in you'd have to marginalize over all of the possible masses, which means that you'd have an intrinsic uncertainty in your results on these fundamental parameters. But if you can measure the mass of the neutrino, either by fitting to it cosmologically, or better yet, by doing a ground-based experiment and just putting these things in as parameters, someone can measure, if you know what that, say you assume three neutrinos and you measure the hierarchy and the mass of the littlest one, then you know the mass of the neutrino sector. But when you do this calculation, or when you do that calculation, you're implicitly assuming that you have a universe that was thermalized at the point where the neutrinos decoupled from the rest of the matter. Because if they didn't, when we measure the mass of the neutrinos and we convert that into an omega nu, then the number density of neutrinos is coming from the fact that we've calculated the number density of neutrinos that you get by saying, they decouple, before the electron protons so then there's a sequence of decouplings that happens in the early universe, and that's how you work out that the neutrino temperature is different from the photon temperature. And so that the number density of neutrinos is something that you can that has a theoretical prior as well, that the very early universe was thermalized. I mean, you have it from Big Bang nuclear synthesis as well, but the scales are different, which two orders of magnitude or something.
It won't tell you anything new, but on the other hand, if you have to think about it, it won't tell you anything new about inflation because the scales are so radically different. But on the other hand, if you're going to look at the CMB, then we know that it's sort of one, you know, once you start thinking about the CMB at the 1% level, then that does care about the mass of the neutrino sector. In fact, you know, the best bounds on the total mass of the neutrino sector come from WMAP, or come from WMAP plus everything else. Yeah, I mean, it's the assumption that you have a kind of minimal neutrino sector, I guess, is the assumption that you make. You know, you're ignoring, you know, massive states and, you know, sterile states and stuff like that.
Your particle physics hat on, and then comment on the string theory attacks on the
fundamental basis. Yeah, I mean, there's brain models are obviously a lovely, you know, something, I mean, a lovely way to do it. The other thing is, you know, you have models that are defined where, you know, you have... I mean, you have a lot of scalar modes in a string theory with a compactification, and particularly these flux compactified backgrounds. So there's lots of scope for it. I think it's fair to say that people have paradigms for constructing models at the moment. I don't think anyone would claim to have a truly compelling model, but it's certainly true that there's this very rich phenomenology that, you know, people have become aware of in string theory in the last, you know, sort of 10 years, essentially, that allows you to, you know, to build. I mean, not so much large extra dimensions, but, you know, thinking more, as you said, sort of brains moving and some. There's some complicated space, but in the end, you know, if the nice thing about string theory is it comes with a set of rules. You know, if you don't have the, you know, microphysics under control, then, you know, you can. For instance, there's this paper by Ava Silverstein recently that where she looks at this lovely model where you have something that does look like a large field model because she's taken a field and sort of wrapped it around a circle, and every time she does that, you store some winding energy in this thing, so it's like a torsional pendulum. And instead of, you know, if you take an axion and you take it all the way around the circle, you just get back to where you started, whereas this time, every time you go around the circle, you store more and more energy, so you've got to make the same number of rotations to get, you know, to get back to the vacuum. And so what this does, it means that this field point will make a, you know, trans, you know, will make an excursion that's equal to, you know, some number of times the Planck scale, but the value of the field itself never becomes particularly large. And so that gives you a very precise mechanism. But on the other hand, then you have to ask, you know, is this model stable against decompactification, for instance? And then because you're doing this inside of string theory, you have to check that the model plays by all of the rules of string theory. So if you can come up with something that's, you know, you can't just write things down. You're not just free to write things down inside of string theory. You actually have to test that it makes sense inside of string theory. And you have some other set of constraints that you have to apply. And I think, in the end, I think that's the most attractive thing about stringy models of inflation, is because the rules of the road are so tight, that if you can find something that makes sense inside of string theory and also produces a nice cosmology, then, you know, you really achieve something. Because you're not free just to write down arbitrary models just by specifying the potential. I mean, these DBI models, originally people hoped that they would, you know, produce a very substantial, a gentleman here actually might know more about this than me, but, you know, very substantial non-Gaussianity in a large scale. And so I think some of the parameter space has been closed down theoretically by the size of this kind of argument. But I think in general, I think the string models of inflation, I think, have to be taken seriously at this point. I think people are thinking very hard about the microphysics.
Well, for me, not all things are really under control in string theory, because if you consider KKLT or racetrack models, you do get nice inflationary features, but on the other hand, you have to tune your parameters of your Calabi-Yau manifold up to one part to 10 to the 5. So,
but 10 to the 5 is not as bad.
It's the same tuning as a standard inflation, where it's just a God-given scalar field and a God-given mass, which gives the same prediction. So I think it's kind of... string theoretical picture certainly is appealing, but on the other hand, I have this feeling that it's kind of misleading, because we're just shifting the problem in some framework which we believe to be closer to some fundamental description.
No, but I think the point is that string theory provides you with an extra set of rules, and so there are some models of inflation that you might try to do in string theory that simply don't work. For instance, these DBI models at large scale, I mean, you can show that they're inconsistent with what you know about string theory, because, you know, it turns out the brain has to essentially again move the Trans-Planckian distance. And so I think from that point of view, I think it's nice to have some other set of rules beyond simply matching what we see in the sky that you have to obey. And that means, you know, if you do find a natural model of inflation inside of string theory, then you haven't simply created that, you've actually found it. And I think in a sense that's the promising thing about string inflation. I think it's true that you can't say that there is no compelling model of inflation that comes out of string theory at the moment for precisely
the sort of reason you're talking about, also simply you just don't know what, you've got the problem, you've got all of these vacua, and also you have all of these possible, if you have a landscape, you've got many, every trajectory through the landscape is potentially an inflationary model. So you can, in principle, at least have many, many inflationary models inside a string theory. But I still think that the fact that you can ask whether or not, the fact that once you know that you're working in string theory, string theory provides you with a whole extra set of questions you can ask about the model. And I think that's important.
I suppose that's the one compelling thing. I mean, there's too many questions.
I don't think that, I think the answer is that string theory, people hoped originally, that you'd find this, you'd be able to calculate the electron mass or something. And I think it's clear that string theory hasn't delivered on that promise because in some sense the theory is too rich. But on the other hand, it's still true that you can ask questions about, whether or not the model is self-consistent, if you put in, the various corrections you'd want to put in, or just whether, whether it's self-consistent mathematically, whether you're talking about, transpiring game depths, for instance. I think that's something that you do have a handle on when you're working inside of any theoretical framework that goes beyond the, simply trying to construct a cosmology. So, I mean, it's not just simply true of string theory, it would be true of any, potential theory or anything. Yeah, no, exactly. In fact, that's been done. In fact, several people have done precisely this kind of analysis for DBI inflation, for instance, as well, where you have, like an arbitrary kinetic term as well as an arbitrary potential term, and, you can write down, some general expression for those things, and you can constrain those three parameters. That's absolutely, whenever you have a class of inflationary models that can be written, or whose phenomenology, whose spectrum can be written in terms of some parameters that sit inside of the potential, you can carry out this process. The one thing you have to watch is that in the end, if you have 10 free parameters, and obviously you can't say anything meaningful about any of them, you have to be able to provide some, in this case we have this very nice cut that, even if the order at which we truncate this hierarchy gives us a very natural classification of classes of models. We have a 2-parameter model or a 3-parameter model. If you wanted to do that, so you have to make sure that you don't have a 10-parameter model. You have to be able to have meaningful differences between the models, but also not 10 parameters.
So if you do have, say, 3-parameter models,
you
can get a
2-point form. Yeah, because you have a non-canonical kinetic term, for instance, would be a classic example. I couldn't tell you right away, but I mean, similar constraints can be performed, is all I'm saying.
But you don't think that this will be ruled out
of most of the way in which you'd go after the non-canonical kinetic term is probably through the non-Gaussianities. Because it's true, I mean, it's generically true that if you have a model where the sound speed, which is controlled by the kinetic term essentially, is not exactly equal to 1, then those models tend to have enhanced non-Gaussianity. So in the CMB alone, you have this FNL parameter that people like to quote. And cosmic variance says you can never measure an FNL of less than 1, thereabouts in the CMB. If you look at the standard value of FNL that's predicted by inflation, it's about 10 to the minus 2. And so on the other hand, these models with funky kinetic terms, that they tend to, they will in some situations allow you to have an FNL that's significantly greater than 1. And so if you were to see that, then you would rule out every kind of slow roll inflation that I've ever talked about, because there's no way that pure slow roll inflation can generate a significant primordial FNL. I mean, obviously you can generate it later on through gravitational interactions between modes, but this primordial FNL at large scales is something that you couldn't explain with simple slow roll inflation. But on the other hand, these models not only can, but in fact probably generically predict. So, the value, as you squeeze down this non-Gaussianity parameter, then you would actually, that would be one of the things that would go into the soup when you were putting this cut in this parameter space.
I'm interested in small mass primordial black hole
formation.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And I understand it's obviously not affected by a red spectrum.
This is an interesting question, actually. In fact, I can expound at some length on this.
Oh.
The interesting thing is that I'll expound quickly. Okay, so the issue is at the end of inflation, if you have inflation that ends with if you have a model like this, the inflaton field decays away like this, if you look at the P of R as a function of phi, that actually goes to zero as inflation rolls away.
But on the other hand, if you have a model where P of R does something like this, so we need it to be decreasing, and then it does that, if this gets up to, I think, 0.01 or something like that, you can produce a substantial number of primordial black holes in the immediately post-inflationary universe. And then it becomes more complicated, because if you produce these things at the gut scale, the amount of stuff that you have inside of the horizon at the gut scale is less than the mass of the black hole that would decay between now and the I think it's 10 to the 15 grams or something you need to have in a black hole in order for it to be stable over the lifetime of the universe. As the horizon expands, even though the temperature cools, the amount of stuff inside of the horizon goes up. And so you need to have the temperature in a thermalized universe of less than about 10 to the 8 GeV in order to produce a stable black hole. So if you were going to do this from gut scale inflation, the modes that would produce black holes are not the modes that are just coming into the horizon right at the end of inflation. They're modes that actually left the horizon some time before the end of inflation. So you have to be a little careful with this. But then you can, if you have this big density fluctuation, if inflation ends in such a way as you get this big spike in the density fluctuation right at the end of inflation, then in principle you can produce these primordial black holes. In some models of inflation, people actually propose this as a decay channel from taking energy out of the inflaton field and into regular matter, because as long as these black holes decay quickly, then you just the Hawking black holes are just going to produce every possible state. So whatever state you have in your theory, you'll produce out of the decay process, and then you don't need the scalar field to be coupled to anything else, because you're producing them through all the subsequent states are produced through a gravitational channel, strong gravity rather than weak gravity. It turns out that if you look just at k to the n, then this n has to, I think, be greater than 1.2 or 1.3 if you're going to, if you want a rising spectrum that will produce black holes at the end of inflation. And it's clear that n is not greater than 1.2. That's very strongly ruled out by data. On the other hand, if you have this dn d log k, and you ask how big that can be in current data, and even if you take the central value of n as being slightly less than 1, it's at least conceivable. In WMAP3, there was a strong preference for this number being less than 0. In WMAP5, that's not true anymore. Like 0 is sort of at 1 sigma from the central value, whereas in WMAP3, it was like a 2 and a bit sigma. So people wrote all these papers on whether or not you had a strong running that came from inflation and got very excited about it. And it was clear, one of the things that Harania and I did was to work out that these models had typically 15 e-folds of inflation. So from an inflationary point of view, that was very bad news. But now that the centroid has moved up a little bit, models with a big enough running, the running can potentially be big enough so that you might actually produce an N by the end of inflation that was up in this area, even though at the CMB scales, N is a lot smaller. And what we see is if you look at WMAP5 alone, the constraint, we actually looked at actually having eternal inflation where delta rho over rho becomes of order 1, so you just can't. But I think the black hole constraint would work in a similar way. The constraints are not wildly different, even though the slightly different. almost done. So in that case, the fact that you don't want to produce primordial black holes at the end of inflation wouldn't have added anything to the WMAP3 data. If you look at WMAP5 data alone, our tentative conclusion is it probably does add a little bit to that. But then if you look at the WMAP5 data plus supernova data, which puts tighter constraints on other parameters and then closes down the running a little bit, then it seems that constraint is actually, then your upper bound on the running is actually roughly the same as you get in this primordial black hole cut. So imposing that doesn't actually give you any extra bite if you look at the full cosmological parameters in the data set and not just WMAP5. But in principle, at least, it's something that you should think about. You have to make sure that inflation ends in a way that doesn't produce anything that will be toxic in the present universe, because if it does, then you can't invoke inflation to explain it away.
I do a lot of detailed analysis.
Well, even if you found a planet-sized black hole, you can't see how to make a black hole astrophysically in something that's less than several solar masses. So any small black hole you see is almost certainly produced in the Big Bang.
But then if you're exploring now, they did schematic study of this. on signatures of people, because now the data will be better, but at that time,
this is still an active area of inquiry. I was looking into this precisely because I realized that I was looking at the models with a high DNDLK, and I looked at that and I saw, well, hang on, if DNDLK is large and positive, then by the time inflation of 30 or 40 e-folds later, it's going to be dangerously large. And so there's dozens of papers written every year, even at the moment, probably on constraints on these models, because you can never rule them out exactly. You just squeeze the parameters. Well, I think people saw the gamma ray business, for instance. People looked at it originally. Yeah. Hawking radiation. Because they have the bigger the black hole, the lower the temperature, the more slowly it decays. But if you have a black hole that was created 13.7 billion years ago and its mass is about 10 to the 15 grams, as it decays, the Hawking temperature goes up and it radiates faster and faster and faster, and eventually you get this kind of runaway explosion where, poof, and a burst of gamma rays. If it's accreting, then obviously if you have inflow and outflow, then obviously you need that. But these black holes are very little, so the stuff that would actually go through the throat is very. Yeah, I think people have included that. In a sense, you have to solve a Boltzmann equation. These things are sitting inside of some background. Wait. All right.
I was just going to say, so there are constraints placed by gamma rays, because then there are arguments about the gamma rays are associated with this. Actually, we're working on the radio part of the spectrum, because the explosion is supposed to first to actually produce coherent radio pulses, and radio pulses are much more sensitive. So even given the searches that have been done,
I mean, there's all kinds of constraints. You wouldn't, for instance, we know that the universe has to have been mostly not ionized between the CMB being formed and the present and the first stars turning on. And so, if you have a bunch of black holes that were popping off, say at a Z of 100, or some dark matter that was decaying, unstable on that sort of timescale, you don't want to be dumping lots of thermal energy into the universe either then or during nuclear synthesis, because that messes things up. So you can also at any point where the universe is kind of fragile against having energy dumped into it, you can then put constraints, both on decaying fundamental particles and also decaying primordial black holes. And because in the case of the black hole, the earlier you're looking, obviously the smaller the black hole is that you're constraining. No, I understand. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not. I mean, so in that sense, what you would do is you'd be able to constrain. We know that these things can't be the dominant mass fraction of the universe, the dark matter, because they're microlensing. But you'd like to know that, that they're one part in a million rather than one part in a thousand, for instance. That's something that would, then you would have a tighter bite on the parameters. Then if you could tighten up the fraction of, because even if you produce these black holes in the very early universe, it's some tiny fraction of the total mass, because you're producing something that scales like matter when the rest of the universe is scaling like radiation. But if you can tighten that if you can get that down even tighter, then obviously the constraints that you'd get on the primordial spectrum would grow tighter because of that. And I think if you just have this one parameter model, and this is this value, this minimal value of the parameter you need for black holes is inconsistent with the data, but a two parameter model, on the other hand, you might in fact just sneak in. I don't think people have looked at this constraint, but no one's really looked at this combined constraint, because I don't think anyone's been motivated to do that. But it'd be a nice exercise for a graduate student.
I think it's about exactly the time to stop, but break for coffee, and we'll start again at 11:00. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, no, I'm all good for Monday. That's great. Yeah. Okay, see you then. Bye. My teeth. I thought I turned it off. Okay. See what they got.
Do you know what? I've got slides in this that are not final. And the slides are not properly used.
You need them.
Can I take them out and give them to you later on?
Yeah. They're false.